On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Today, we have a most unusual and fascinating story to tell you. World War II was fought on so many continents, in so many places, with so many people. There are bound to be stories that are new to us. This one is one of which I have never heard the slightest inkling of it occurring. And so I'm really thrilled to get a chance to talk to you about it. Our guest today is Gavin Mortimer, who is the author of numerous books about wartime special forces, including the SAS in World War II and Illustrated History, the SBS in World War II and Illustrated History, his biography of the David Sterling entitled The Phony Major, The Life, Times, and Truth About the Founder of the SAS, and his newest book is Z Special Unit, the Elite Allied World War II Guerrilla Force. It's from Osprey Books. Gavin is the historical consultant on a 2017 BBC documentary about the wartime SAS and has conducted World War II battlefield tours with serving members of the regiment. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be here. And if I may just say so, I've also written a history of Merrill's Marauders, that wonderful American unit. And I had the honor and the privilege of interviewing several of the Marauders. I think, unfortunately, there's only two left now. That was an extraordinary story to tell too. And as you said, that's right. My speciality is wartime special forces and private armies, as they were known. And they were just so many extraordinary, remarkable stories contained within them.
I suppose one of the reasons that we don't hear much about them is that they were secret and that not everybody made it back from the missions, but there was an ongoing mission to defeat the Japanese or defeat the Germans, and therefore they really couldn't be discussed for a very long time, even after the war was over, because of the Cold War. Has that been a factor in writing about them?
It has. I mean, that's particularly pertinent to Z Special Unit. That's they were for many years, really for 30 years after the war, they were kept under wraps what they had accomplished, because exactly as you said, because of the Cold War and they were using in one of their raids, Rimmel, which was unfortunately ended in a tragic failure, but they were using a new type of secret weapon which the Allies, the Australians, the Americans, the British thought would be very useful against the USSR. And so that's why, so exactly, it's so many of the men didn't really have the opportunity to tell their story until many years later.
Now, you had the opportunity to actually visit with some of the surviving team members, correct? Or family members of those surviving team members.
On this operation, that's right. Not many of them. I did have the great good fortune to interview Michael Tibbs, who was the last. He was an officer, a British submarine officer, and he is the last. He's still with us, 101. The last survivor, really, of Z Special Unit. His job was to make the rendezvous with this operation in 1944, Rimmel, which ended in failure. But he had some very interesting things to say. And obviously, it's just, as I mentioned with the Marauders just a couple of minutes ago, it's that sort of almost touching history when you speak to these old guys and their memories are so sharp, because obviously they were, yes, it was many years ago, but they were young men, and these were events that were branded on their memories forever. And and I also interviewed relatives of some of the operatives involved in these missions, and they passed on photographs and diaries and what have you. So that really helps to bring alive the story.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Z Special Unit. It was apparently a section of the Special Operations Australia, the SAO, which was an offshoot of Britain's Special Operations Executive, also known as the SOE, and was essentially put together in April of 42. The United States had just gotten into the war a few months earlier, and a catastrophic event occurred in Southeast Asia at the same time it was occurring or it was in progress at the same time the attack on Pearl Harbor took place. That was the fall of Singapore, which is considered to be the most serious defeat of any British military, I guess, in British in history?
Correct. So that's right, the fall of Singapore in February 42. And it's often, I suppose, it's overlooked in a way that because of Pearl Harbor and the, well, of course, its significance, not just in the number of sailors and other personnel lost that day, but also it brought America into the war, which is has been well documented, to the joy really of Winston Churchill, who knew that with America in the war and of course with Russia in the war too, that defeat was inevitable for Germany and for Japan. But that wasn't the case for the first few months, and in the weeks after Pearl Harbor, Japan just really swept through Southeast Asia, robbing Britain, if that's seizing from Britain, mm-hmm. all its territories, Malaya, Hong Kong, I mean, but the jewel in the crown, if you like, in that region, Southeast Asia, was Singapore, and that was taken. And as you said, it was a humiliating defeat for the British. The worst. Winston Churchill was just could not believe it, and made unfavorable comparisons to the fighting qualities of a World War One soldier, and said that this new generation just didn't have the fighting spirit. And 1942 was, from a British point of view anyway, the low point of the war. The war in North Africa wasn't going well, with Rommel and the Afrika Korps. And as you mentioned, though, that really the only way at this time, until the vast resources of America came to bear in the Pacific theater and Southeast Asia, the only way for the British to strike back, as was the case, of course, in second half of 1940-41 against the Germans in Western Europe, was through guerrilla warfare, irregular warfare. So with the commandos, which were set up at the instigation of Churchill in the summer of 1940, and they carried out guerrilla raids on German targets off the predominantly the French coast. And then, as you mentioned, Special Operations Australia, which I suppose is the best way to describe that. That would be the equivalent of the American, the Office of Strategic Services, OSS. And they looked at ways of, I mean, a good way of defining guerrilla warfare is the materially weak against the materially strong. So in 1942, the British were materially weak, but they did have an ingenuity and an audaciousness that was glaringly absent from the Japanese mindset.
Right.
And they, so they formed a unit, Z Special Unit, and their job was to hit back more than anything, not so much in terms of material damage, but psychologically.
Right. This whole episode here reminds me a lot of the idea behind the Doolittle raid that the United States participated in. It really wasn't going to be all that destructive, but what it was going to do was be extraordinarily detrimental to the morale of the Japanese, who had been told for over a decade that they were absolutely invincible, that they were the top race in the world, that nobody was going to ever beat them. There wasn't even a word for surrender in the Japanese language. And for them to have these guys somehow get into Singapore Harbor and for ships to mysteriously blow up was an extraordinary event.
Absolutely. That's right. It's important to, one can't convey enough the psychological hold that Japanese had over the Western psyche at the beginning of a war, because right. as I said, they swept through, they conquered all this land very quickly. They believed that they were invincible, and even sections of, you know, their propaganda was the Americans, the British are degenerate, they are corrupt morally and spiritually, they do not have our fighting spirit. And of course, that was a pretty easy sell, considering the success that the Japanese had had. And quite rightly, that you said there, the Doolittle raid was just a reminder to the Japanese people that the Americans did have the ability to strike back. Yes, initially in a small way, but nonetheless that was significant. And a Z Special Unit, in my opinion, it's one of the great Special Forces raids of the war.
Oh yeah.
And also one of the least known.
I was fascinated to read the things that these guys did, the arduous thing, all of the planning and everything else. The first attack, where they were just basically barely had the kind of equipment that they needed to do in order to do this, but they managed to make it work. There, we should mention some names. Ivan Lyon, L-Y-O-N, what a fascinating guy. What an incredible character. You couldn't make up somebody in a spy novel any better than this guy.
No, you absolutely. And one of those characters that war throws up. And he was an upper class Briton. One associates of, certainly in that era, of the rather straight laced, upright, rather stiff sort of I say chaps, that sort of Englishman. But he was a maverick. He had a on his chest after a drunken night in Singapore. He was a regular army officer in the a Scottish regiment, the Gordon Highlanders. But he, after one night, he had a tattoo on his chest of a large a tiger's head.
Right.
He scorned spending. He scorned the ex. He was based in Singapore in the late 30s, but he took himself out of that sort of expat community that, you know, was drinking pink gins and playing croquet and doing what British army officers did when they were stationed in the colonies in the 1930s. He took a small boat and sailed it round many, many little islands around Singapore and to the north, to the south. And this, of course, came in very useful when war broke out, because he had an intimate knowledge, not just of the islands, but of the tides the coves, the nooks and crannies. And so this enabled him, as you said, to plan meticulously the raid on Singapore Harbour. He had with him another extraordinary officer, another Briton called Donald Davidson, again, a vicar's son, an eccentric character who had lived in Borneo for a number of years as a rubber planter, and his speciality was canoeing. And then they recruited Australians and Australian sailors, and I think that they complemented each other very well, because you had these rather eccentric, unorthodox English officers allied to these tough as teak Australians who had great self-discipline, and if handled right by their officers, also just worked formidably well as a team.
Now, we're talking, in case you're just joining us, to Gavin Mortimer, who is the author of numerous books about wartime special forces. The one we're discussing today is Z Special Unit, the Elite Allied World War II Guerrilla Force. It's from Osprey Publishing. And another great thing about this story is that he's written about a number of SAS and SOE, and he's also written about Merrill's Marauders, which was an American guerrilla force. This is his specialty. And this particular situation that he's discussing here was an incredible operation, with the idea of just a handful of guys getting back at the Japanese for taking over Singapore and imprisoning 125,000 British troops. First leg of this operation is amazingly successful, and that is Operation Jaywick.
That's named after a type of air freshener from the 1930s, apparently. they had some great help from the U.S. submarine base, which was at Exmouth Gulf, and that is on the northwest coast of Australia. In fact, the Admiral Ralph Christie, who was the U.S. commander of submarines in that area, asked them to Ivan Lyon, the commanding officer of Operation Jaywick, to also just really gather intelligence, because he wanted, as at that time in the war, this is September 1943, Allied submarines hadn't yet patrolled through the Lombok Strait up towards Singapore. And so they were also going on this guerrilla raid, undertaking a guerrilla raid, but at the same time gathering intelligence for hopefully future submarine patrols. And they set out, it was 2,000 miles from the Exmouth Gulf in northwestern Australia to the target, Singapore Harbour. They set out in a 70-foot fishing boat, the Krait, and named after this type of snake. And they used dye to cover their they smeared their bodies in dye so that they would look like indigenous fishermen if buzzed by a Japanese aircraft, which did happen on a couple of occasions. And they sailed to within 25 miles of Singapore, at which point the six men chosen to actually penetrate Singapore Harbour left the crate in three canoes, two-man canoes. And then they island hopped, in effect, because, of course, one has to remember this area was rife with Japanese. There were Japanese seaplane bases, naval bases, and even though the Japanese were complacent because there had been no commando raids, they had a heavy presence, but they weren't particularly diligent in their patrolling because they were overconfident. And this, of course, was exploited by the six raiders. And the other thing is that the canoes that they were using were wonderfully basic compared to what we know today. They were really just made of wood and covered in canvas. And there were 700 pounds each canoe carried 700 pounds of kit. Yeah, if they had 2 weeks of rations and water and their clothing, and then they had 100 pounds of explosives, limpet mines. And they paddled towards the target. Their final island was a little uninhabited island called Dungus, which was 8 miles south of Singapore. Here they established an observation post, and they surveyed the island with a telescope. And then on the night of the 26th of September, 1943, they set out for the target. Now, they separated quite early on. The three canoes each had a section of the Singapore Harbour, was a large harbour with various different entrances and exits, and they each knew, having scouted it from the observation post, their target. So in the pitch dark, they approached the ships, and the way that they laid the mines was that three sailors, the sailors in the front of the canoe would hold on with a magnetic clamp to the ship's hull, and then the officer would, using a stick, would very carefully maneuver the limpet mine just under the water until he heard that sort of reassuring clamp onto the side of a hull, and then they would move on to the next one. Now, there on two instances, as this was going on, they were aware of sailors up above them, just standing on the deck, having a cigarette, looking out at sea, and so the tension was great. But they laid all their mines successfully, and then they set off for the rendezvous island, which was approximately 40 miles away. And the limpet mines had timed fuses on them to go off at approximately 4 hours after they'd been laid. So if you can imagine, they were going hell for leather in those 4 hours, because they knew they had to get away from Singapore Harbour as quickly as possible. The mines exploded. They damaged seven ships. Two were sent to the bottom of the sea. And what was fascinating was that the Japanese, they presumed that the attack had come from inland, from shore. There had been commandos coming through Singapore. They never imagined, it just didn't occur to them that the Allies had it, had the wherewithal to launch a seaborne guerrilla raid. So in fact, the six raiders were able to canoe back to the islands, the rendezvous islands, unmolested by Japanese aircraft, because they'd headed north. They didn't go south because they thought, well, they clearly obviously hadn't come from south, from Australia. And so they rendezvoused with the crate, the fishing trawler, and then returned back to the US submarine base at Exmouth Gulf in northwestern Australia on the 19th of October after 47 days at sea and having covered 4,000 miles.
Wow. If that's the only thing they had even attempted, that would be worth telling. That is incredible. And the Japanese were completely befuddled. They had no idea. And sadly enough, they went after natives, assuming that they had become guerrilla fighters and that they had blown it up. And it took quite a while and a lot of torture, apparently, before they found out that nobody knew what happened. Nobody understood how this could have happened. And at that point, the Japanese began starting to look. That will have a very negative impact on the next mission of the Z Special Unit under Tony Lyon. And one of the things that you mentioned is the what they call the Sleeping Beauty, called the world's smallest submarine. It's a one-man craft about the size of a canoe that could, and the pilot is wearing scuba gear, basically, and you could dive for a short amount of time and therefore get under ships and all. It was a pretty cool idea, but unfortunately, it turned out that these guys were going to be sort of the test pilots for the Sleeping Beauties, and they didn't work as well in the mission as they had hoped.
I think it's just important. I mean, you say you're absolutely right. That's a good analysis there. The beauty of the JWIC raid was in its simplicity. It relied really on the initiative of the men, the endurance of the men, the courage of the men. The next raid, the Rima raid, which was a year later, it was too ambitious. The yeah. Sleeping Beauties, that's right. They were a wonderful invention, as you described them very accurately, but they had never really, they hadn't been tested in combat before, in a mission before. So I think the phrase I use to describe them in the book are guinea pigs.
Yeah.
And of course, during training, there were problems with them. And when the men, in the first raid, with the canoes, you're just relying, the men went there knowing that it was, their fate was in their hands. In this raid, their fate wasn't in their hands really, because they had this very complex equipment. And I think at the back of their minds, that would have been a problem. And of course, the other huge drawback was that they had to come in much closer to Singapore, because these were big one-man submarines.
Right.
There were 15 of them. So they had to hijack a local Indonesian fishing boat, big enough to be able to transport these. So the submarine that had taken them there, they then had to spend a day on loading them onto this Indonesian fishing boat, a junk. And so that, again, left them more exposed, made them more vulnerable. And ultimately, they were spotted by a patrol boat. And once compromised, it was really a case of every man for himself. And over the course of several weeks, they were hunted down in individually in twos and threes, and no one survived the mission.
Right. According to the picture that you have of the marker in Singapore, there were 13 of them that were killed in action, including Tony Lyon, 10 others that were captured, tried without any defense, and that were beheaded, and not very well. Nobody survived the mission, as you said, but the fact that they tried it, and the fact that that made the Japanese nervous, and I've read some other books about the war as it affected Borneo, and one of the things that I had read in another book was that there were Japanese soldiers who were actually encouraged and actually surrendered in Borneo in that theater, which had never happened before.
The third mission, if you like, of Z Special Unit was in Borneo. That was parachuting in and working with the indigenous population, the natives, the fearsome Dayaks, who were headhunters, and they were encouraged by the Z Special Unit to the British colonial rulers in the 20s and 30s had tried to eradicate the practice of headhunting, considering it unchristian. But during the war, needs must, etc., and so they were encouraged to. And of course, again, we talked about the psychological aspect. This put the fear of God into the Japanese, and as did the blowpipe. The blowpipe was a very effective weapon in the hands of a Borneo native, and the Japanese were terrified of it. So it was, and this was a very, I suppose, one of the pioneers of the hearts and mind policies. And of course, we know we associate very closely with America and forces in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That one of the things that the Z Special Unit did was that a medic would parachute in with a large medical bag, and he would treat the diseases such as dysentery and scrub typhus and malaria and just general more common ailments. And of course, to the natives, this is wonderful. They'd never seen this miraculous medicine, and so they worked very closely with the Allies. And when the Australian 9th Division invaded Borneo in June the 10th, 1945, there was in place a very strong and well-trained guerrilla network, which was able to attack the Japanese. You had the Australians attacking from the coastal regions, from the invasion beaches, and then from the interior, you had the native guerrilla units, who were very, very good at what they were trained to do.
It is an extraordinary story, Gavin, and I am just thrilled that I had the opportunity to read your book and learn more about it, and that you agreed to talk to us over Teams.
Well, pleasure.
From Great Britain and share your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Is there anything that you wanted to say that I neglected to ask?
The fact that what the Jaywick raids, I think, is such a good example of what a small band of highly trained, highly motivated guerrilla fighters can do. And I think that it's something that I believe is still studied, certainly by the Australian Special Forces, as a textbook Special Forces operation. And it's just tragic that only five of the men who took part in Operation Jaywick lost their lives on Operation Remo. Only one didn't go on the on that mission, and he survived, Arthur Jones. And so I think Jaywick, that was one of the purposes of writing the book, really to make people, military history enthusiasts, more aware of Operation Jaywick, what it achieved, and the example of, as I said, of what a small band of courageous and audacious and bold men can achieve.
Indeed. It's a wonderful story and an incredible tribute to their courage and their tenacity and their training. Thank you for bringing it to us. It is absolutely fascinating, and it certainly deserves to be known and to be celebrated. Thank you very much. Website? Do you have a website that people can go to for more
information? I do, yep. GavinMortimer.com.
All right, Gavin, again, thank you so much. And listen, the next time you come out with a book, I want to get a chance to talk to you again. I've enjoyed this very much.
So have I. It'd be a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest today, Gavin Mortimer, the author of Z Special Unit, The Elite World War II Guerrilla Force, from Osprey Publishing. Thanks so much for joining us today. Look forward to seeing you again next Sunday right here on your favorite radio station, or anytime on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.